This is a mental model that you have that refines itself over and over after you get burned and when you've seen things work that you didn't think would work.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow at UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin. I'm a critical care fellow in Washington, D.C.
Well, today we're excited to have Dr. Nader Yahya back with us on the podcast. You don't remember from our previous conversation, Dr. Yahya is a pediatric intensivist and ARDS researcher at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's an excellent clinical researcher looking at the biomarkers, epidemiology, and many other aspects of pediatric ARDS. But he also is a great communicator and can effectively tell us all of this knowledge that he has learned at the bedside and at the bench.
Yes, you might have heard him on our other ARDS episodes, and we were so excited to step things up this time. So today we're going to be talking about the use of non-invasive ventilation to capture kids with developing ARDS early, and my favorite clinical pearl of all of our podcast, which is really, when do you intubate this patient?
Yeah, let's get into it. Well, welcome back to Pete's Grit. We are so excited to have Dr. Nader Yahya back with us today to discuss pediatric ARDS. Welcome back, Nader.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
So many of our listeners will have listened to our fundamentals or essentials of pediatric ARDS that we did with the Cribsiders. But maybe if they haven't, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and maybe share something you enjoy outside of medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a doctor of intensive care medicine in the PICU at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I trained in California, did my undergrad at Berkeley, my med school at UCLA, my residency in Peds at Children's LA. I came out to Philadelphia for fellowship, and I've stayed here as faculty since then. I've done primarily ARDS research in like the translational and clinical space and a little bit of the preclinical space. But mostly like right now, I'm focused on like translational and clinical epidemiology. And outside of medicine, I'm a dad, I have two daughters, and I watch an inordinate amount of football. Like, I really enjoy professional football, which lives in tension with how much I dislike the NFL as an organization. And I think that's me.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining us again. Nader, how did you get interested in pediatric ARDS research?
I had a really excellent respiratory therapist, PhD trained, who was one of the first RTs that I started working with at CHOP, who taught me a lot about conventional ventilators. And so all the fellows, when we started, were tasked with like having to give like a fellowship lecture to like the residents and things like that. Nobody had picked up mechanical ventilation, so I got assigned that one. And so I used like one of the attendings who was here at the time, their stock mechanical ventilation lecture as like a structure to build off of. And I started like reading that lecture, and I was talking about some of the points in this as a first year fellow with one of the respiratory therapists who like nuanced my understanding of it. He didn't straight up call the attending wrong or their slides wrong, but he kind of suggested that it could have been more right. And that actually got me thinking of like, how much do we actually know about the stuff that I'm going to be teaching kids? And so like, I hated that idea of perpetuating myth or perpetuating dogma that's just inaccurate or something. And so that prompted me to like start investigating in this specific area because one, I had to give a lecture, and two, it's like kind of cool. And so I started looking into that. The deeper I dug, the more I found out like, oh, there's a fair amount of gaps about what we know and don't know. And how well can you really extrapolate some of the adult findings to children? And even a lot of the adult findings are not particularly like on as solid footing as one might imagine. And so that entire enterprise rabbit holed me into this direction.
That's very fun. It's interesting to hear those key early experiences that seemingly direct your career for a number of years following. Nader, I know you do a lot of things, but if you were to concisely describe what exactly you are currently interested in inside of pediatric ARDS research, how would you say that?
How to design and execute more informative trials for a rare disease process with modest mortality.
Yeah, that's the black box or the most difficult thing that's part of a lot of things that we take care of in PICU, right? Mortality is so low. How can you design a trial that really demonstrates what we're doing at the bedside is effective or maybe not?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a challenge. And like, we're trying to tackle it from like a lot of the epi stuff that I do, a lot of the like clinical epidemiology studies that I do, a lot of it is with a bent towards trying to do trials differently or better and learn from the experiences that we've had from existing trials, like things that worked and didn't work, and like all kind of iteratively moving us towards something which is potentially more practice changing, more efficiently.
Yeah. If there's any other fellows out there like Alice or me, or maybe an early PICU attending, do you have any recommendations or advice for them if they want to become more involved in this area?
Yeah. So go to American Thoracic Society meetings. And I know PICU has a very strong footprint in SCCM and the Society of Critical Care Medicine. And it's excellent. It's a great meeting. It's got a lot of the critical care faculty and institutions represented. And their science is excellent. American Thoracic Society also has like really, really excellent science. And PICU has less of a footprint in that group. It's got thoracic in the title. So for ARDS researchers, I think it's like a pretty strong like other conference to go to. And so maybe not as a fellow where you may have to pick and choose where you spend your PE money or how much support you get if you're not presenting or something like that. But as certainly as you become junior faculty, if you're moving into this space, by then you're making attending money, usually a lighter schedule. And so like you should be able to try to figure out a way to get to this as the second conference. The other organization, which is worth a shout out right now, is PALISI, the Pediatric Acute Lung Injury and Sepsis Investigator Meeting. So that has a lot of fellow and junior faculty training stuff as in terms of like specific games review, grant writing assistance, and a lot of content expertise of people who are participated in like prior cohort studies or in existing randomized control trials. And they get together like twice a year. And so that one is like a smaller meeting that numbers like, you know, just Perry 1,000 rather than like 20,000 like American Thoracic Society or 10,000 like SCCM. But it's a good dedicated 1,000. PALISI is not a funded organization. So like everybody who comes there, okay, is like investing in like in trying to make this community. And so you can gain a lot of experience and contacts from people. So like probably PALISI and American Thoracic Society are things if you're not already part of, like do that.
Oh, wow. That's very actionable advice. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
Alice, you want to present our case for today?
Yeah. So we've got a 6-year-old boy admitted to the PICU with hypoxemic respiratory failure, secondary to polyviral and superimposed bacterial pneumonia. He was fluid resuscitated and started on antibiotics and high flow and is in the emergency department. His x-ray has bilateral opacities with small pleural effusions. He's tachypneic with moderate work of breathing. And the ICU team is thinking that he's developing ARDS. So here we've got a patient who's been started on high flow relatively early. How do you think about the role of high flow nasal cannula as these kids present with their illness and start to develop a worsening illness picture?
So I think that high flow like has kind of taken a lot of ICUs and in some institutions floors in the last 15 years, and it's trying to find itself in a hierarchy of respiratory supports. The 2 or 3 good trials have really been in the bronchiolitis population, which certainly bronchiolitis can cause ARDS, okay? But bronchiolitis is also its own distinct entity. Like that is to say, the same virus can cause bronchiolitis, can also progress to ARDS. And that's even without superinfection. Bad RSV can just be bad RSV and then it starts like tearing up your lung, or it's causing enough of an inflammatory reaction for whatever reason. Some people get ARDS and some people don't. Like you could straight up just have ARDS from this. With respect to high flow, the reason why it's worth using bronchiolitis as a reference point is because high flow grew up in that infant toddler cohort. And the reason it did that is because the mechanism by which it's thought to work is twofold. So one, primarily dead space washout. All right. And that dead space washout is just a much bigger factor when the reason you're breathing fast is as an infant, you have like this anatomic dead space of your nose and your head. Okay. And you've all seen babies. I mean, by and large, their heads are like just ridiculous proportion to their body. And that works against them when they start breathing fast, because then now their guppy breathing, their rapid shallow breathing is working against them because they're gupping in and out of their inordinately large head and nose. And that oronasopharynx is causing dead space. And so like being able to deliver fresh gas directly faster down, bypassing some of that dead space or dead space washout is thought to be a major mechanism to reduce work of breathing by improving ventilation and like actually getting more effective ventilation rather than half dead space ventilation or more higher fraction of dead space ventilation than you want. So that only works if you have a substantial amount of dead space. So that mechanism will become less and less a reason why high flow reduces work of breathing as a kid gets older and their head becomes more proportionally shaped to their body, we hope. But so if you're talking about like a 1-year-old with the same presentation, you could argue that like messing around with high flow for a bit and actually seeing if you can get to 1.5 to 2 liters per kilo per minute is a very reasonable thing to do to see if it reduces work of breathing and reduces FiO2. However, as you get older and older, you have to invoke another mechanism of how high flow works. And that is primarily oxygen delivery. All right, like high flow will improve oxygen delivery because like if you and I have a normal inspiratory flow or a minute ventilation, you know, right now I probably have a peak inspiratory flow rate of something like, you know, 20, 30 liters a minute. And when I'm dyspneic, that can go up. That can go up to like 50, 60 liters a minute. When you guys put somebody on a volume control ventilator, mostly in adult ICUs, less so in pediatric ICUs where we use decelerating flow, But in those ventilators, a lot of times you'll have to set the flow. So you match that flow to like somewhere between 30 and 60 liters a minute. And that is something that adult practitioners are very used to when they use volume control. So partly what you're doing is you're matching that work that is being demanded. So you can imagine that if I'm like on like 2 liters nasal cannula or even like 4 liters, you know, like I'm a reasonable 70 kilo male or whatever. And like I have a 4 liter nasal cannula in my nose and I'm breathing with an inspiratory flow, like a peak inspiratory flow of something like in 50, 60 liters. Those other 46 liters per minute are room air. So I've like massively diluted this oxygen, right? Whereas if you're delivering to somebody my size, 60 liters a minute of high flow via a vapotherm system or like a high flow system, then like you're matching closer to my inspiratory demand of oxygen. So that increased oxygen delivery is a distinct mechanism of high flow. And that ends up being one mechanism by which you could plausibly argue that like I should try somebody who could be developing ARDS or is like sicker than I expected them to be from whatever diagnosis. Okay, just better FiO2 delivery. All right. The third mechanism that's occasionally invoked for high flow, which is probably not a major contributor, particularly in older children, is the generation of some degree of CPAP. That, unfortunately, is a little bit more dependent on leak and things like that, such that like it's not as consistent of a mechanism to invoke. And it's probably not the major mechanism for most patients for why high flow works. Okay, like you can certainly generate probably some non-zero pressure, but it's not going to be the difference between like intubate and not intubate, I don't think. In the trials for bronchiolitis, okay, people have compared nasal cannula to high flow and nasal cannula to CPAP. And the combination of those trials, keeping in mind it's bronchiolitis is a distinct population, but it's also the population in which if high flow is going to work, it's probably going to work the best. High flow probably has a hierarchical relationship such that it goes nasal cannula, high flow, then CPAP. And the reason for that is you can tell this from the reanalyses and the ultimate analyses and publication of these trials is that the rescue mode for high flow failure tended to be CPAP, but the rescue mode for CPAP failure tended not to be high flow, it tended to be BiPAP. So you can tell that people are kind of establishing a natural hierarchy, and that does seem to be the appropriate consideration for high flow. So this particular patient, I forgot how old they were already. Thank you. So this is a population in which the FiO2 elements of high flow, like just higher oxygen delivery, may be a plausible mechanism by which high flow could be tried. However, the predictors of high flow failure and the predictors of CPAP failure and the predictors of BiPAP failure are all very similar. Reduction in heart rate, reduction in respiratory rate, and reduction in FiO2. And if those things don't happen in a timely manner, typically within a couple hours, they're vaguely defined because different studies have different thresholds. And so the precise calibration of this is not noted. But in general, that is a true statement. Like failure modes are defined by an inability to actually demonstrate any sort of short-term physiologic improvement in things like heart rate, respiratory rate, FiO2. And so in ARDS or developing or concern for ARDS, the implication of that is exactly that. That like if I have been unable to wean down to some reasonable FiO2, like 40%, or if I've been unable to see any improvement in respiratory rate or heart rate, then you could plausibly argue that whatever mode you tried, whether it was high flow, CPAP, or BiPAP, okay, that you have not actually captured any sort of deranged physiology and like you're better off escalating. Whatever that escalation actually is, okay, is going to be, you know, a little bit institution and patient dependent. But there's absolutely like some indication that whatever you were trying to capture, you did not capture.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
The last thing I'll say about that is that occasionally you'll be in a situation where like you have a patient who you don't want to necessarily escalate. Like I can imagine some end stage stem cell transplants, CF patients. Okay, some patients who like you actually kind of recognize that if you were to intubate, even if they weren't necessarily DNR or DNI, that you have some suspicion that this pathophysiology and this particular substrate may not extubate. In those situations, as long as you're having a clear conversation with everybody, I think it's also defendable to like try different modes, even if in a broader population, you would not necessarily do that. But I think that's more of a communication answer rather than like a straight supportive care answer.
Oh, yeah. Even if you're not seeing a response, you may still have some benefit that's less tangible.
Yeah, like one more day awake with the family, right? But I think at that point, you're like just having a discussion about you need to know what you're doing and not doing with respect to that patient.
And earlier on, you communicated or you suggested maybe there's a continuum of respiratory support from nasal cannula to high flow to CPAP to BiPAP. Do you kind of see it as that in pediatric ARDS, or do you see using CPAP as BiPAP for different maybe subtypes of ARDS patients in front of you? Does that make sense?
I personally think of it as kind of a severity marker. CPAP and BiPAP work differently. Okay, relatedly, but differently. And they are certainly degrees of support. Like, you know, CPAP is providing the same level of pressure through inspiration and expiration, but it's not providing any additional inspiratory assist. So like patients who are dyspneic because they've de-recruited so much that they're trying to re-recruit, then like CPAP's not necessarily going to help you re-recruit. Their own musculature is responsible for re-recruiting. And then the CPAP is there to try to maintain whatever they re-recruit. And so you're not going to get any reduction in work of breathing. But that being said, the patient may not be sick enough to necessarily need a reduction in work of breathing. Alternatively, BiPAP actually does provide you some inspiratory assist with the IPAP, and then you try to maintain that with the EPAP, so it can help you recruit as well as try to maintain your recruitment.
Yeah.
Now, something that Zach and I were just talking about before you came on with regards to reduction of work of breathing, which I really appreciate because this wasn't my mental model prior, is that not only is it about preventing an arrest, but also about preventing patient-inflicted lung injury. Are they pulling tidal volumes? Are they creating a transpulmonary pressure gradient that's damaging their lung? And can you reduce that by an earlier intubation? Is this a framework that you use?
No. I personally actually reflect more on the initial framework that you described. But I'm aware of the patient-inflicted lung injury or the patient self-inflicted lung injury or the PCILI type framework. Mm-hmm. I'm just not entirely sure where it fits in. It is certainly like an intriguing problem. So the idea here, just make sure you and I are talking about the same thing, Alice.
Yeah.
The idea is that even if I have a patient on like a BiPAP with an IPAP of 18 and an EPAP of 10, is it possible that that patient, they're so dyspneic because they're so sick, their ARDS is so bad, and I haven't intubated them yet, that they themselves are actually generating negative pressures of minus 20, minus 30, such that their transpulmonary pressure is actually like not 18, which is displayed by the BiPAP machine, but actually like 18 minus, minus 20, minus 30, minus 40. So like something like actually more like, you know, 38, 48, or 58. And so the concern there is like, are you actually damaging the lung in a way that you can't actually see it or monitor it? So you're underappreciating this lung damage. And can that be mitigated by actual intubation? And so that's a very intriguing hypothesis. There's two separate elements there. One of them is you picked up on already is the fact that like I'm actually exposing the lung very directly, the lung to unanticipated high transpulmonary pressures. And so is that damaging? And it sounds like it probably is damaging because most of those numbers would add up to numbers that exceed what we consider safe thresholds, like around, you know, plateau pressures of 30. That's still like if the patient's dyspneic, pulling their own negative pressures, that's certainly like a contributing number that you have to account for, right? So there's that pulmonary part of it. There's also the cardiovascular part of it. So the same transpulmonary pressure, the same negative pressure that you're exerting is also exerting afterload on the heart. Okay. And so I actually think PCILI, or the concept of patient self-inflicted lung injury, may actually be a combination of pulmonary edema that is plausibly a direct lung injury, parenchymal, like I'm messing up the lung with like parenchymal problems, as well as like subclinical heart failure. You're actually like putting a cross clamp across the aorta and causing some degree of back pressure from this afterload that you've induced. Okay, that's actually causing some like cardiogenic pulmonary edema, which obviously at bedside clinically, it's all just wet lungs to me. I'm not going to know until I do it, right? But could be that this is actually a multifactorial way that you're actually jacking the patient, in which by like letting them be dyspneic. Incidentally, some of that will still happen if they're intubated. Like if you have an intubated but under-sedated or under-supported patient, and you have a PIP that measures at 20, but they themselves are pulling minus 20, your actual transpulmonary pressure is 40. And the only way to know that is to like either have some like sort of surrogate, like an esophageal manometer, or to paralyze them and actually see what their PIP goes to, or get like a plateau pressure and just hope that you capture a plateau pressure at like a time when like they're relatively quietly breathing to see like what it could rise to. Like you could do like an inspiratory hold for a super long period of time and see like what is this pressure actually equilibrate out to. So there are ways to get at that information, but most of the time when people are just walking by the ventilator and they see the PIP is 20 and without any other monitoring or without an assessment of like how hard they're breathing, then like you end up in this situation where you're like falsely reassured. But that can also happen on, both on BiPAP as well as intubated. And then there's the cardiovascular piece of it, which I think does contribute to some degree. Why don't I think about it that way? I don't, because like the PCILI studies have been partly like confounded by the fact that you're always looking at population that very often ends up getting intubated anyway. And so like a lot of those patients who you're measuring those pressures on are themselves dyspneic. And so the ones that have the worst pressure swings from P. cilli are also the sickest patients. And so is the actual confounder like how bad their ARDS was from the get-go or the fact that they were dyspneic on BiPAP? But dyspneic people on BiPAP get intubated. And so, but sicker ARDS also gets intubated. So like it could be an epiphenomenon rather than truly causal. That's why I'm a little bit agnostic about it. That and like if I'm looking at somebody B dyspneic, my head goes to the same place whether it's P. cilli or whether it's work of breathing. Yeah, I end up intubating. And so like I'm reductionist enough that if it didn't change what I was going to do, like I just, I end up like, yeah. But being able to like think about these different phenomena, I think that it's absolutely worth investigating. But the confounder in the P. cilli studies to me has been the severity of illness.
Yeah. You know, much of what we talked about with the role of non-invasive for managing these patients with ARDS is how much physiologic derangement, how much tachypnea, how much work of breathing do we tolerate on non-invasive support before we actually decide to intubate? So clinically speaking, do you have any general guidelines where you draw the line where you think, you know, this patient has blank derangement, we're requiring this amount of pressure, this amount of FiO2, it's probably not worth continuing to manage on non-invasive?
Trajectory, rate of trajectory, underlying substrate, predicted natural history, and FiO2 is probably my most reliable indicators. I've also mentioned heart rate and respiratory rate in terms of work of breathing, because like the argument being that like some bronchiolytics, for example, also referencing bronchiolitis, as a population that can be plausibly tachypneic with a heart rate of 110. You know, they could have double the respiratory rate of normal for age with a heart rate of 110, suggesting that they are not necessarily feeling like they're running a marathon. I think a lot of the era of high flow and increased monitoring of bronchiolitis, despite the entire era of 1990s and aughts research in bronchiolitis being de-intensifying, the advent of high flow and the use of high flow and CPAP has actually like reversed that trend to very much over-intensifying bronchiolitis. I think the lesson there is you can disentangle to some degree work of breathing from tachypnea. And then we can start getting comfortably tachypneic back into our vocabulary and actually try to operationalize that as what that means. Like this is tachypnea without hemodynamic instability or significant work of breathing, or hemodynamically significant work of breathing or significant hypoxemia. So just because like some of the more fuzzier terms that we use are a little bit harder to grasp, particularly at the training stage, where you see like somebody says that this person has work of breathing and this other person says, no, they're comfortably tachypneic. And, you know, PGY2 is looking at that baby and saying like, same baby.
Yeah.
It's like two different people looked at the exact same thing and they came up with like vitally divergent answers based on what they wanted to do anyway. So like, I think from a training perspective, it's important to like kind of get some of this vocabulary down. So the way I think about that is that you can disentangle hemodynamically significant work of breathing and clinically significant hypoxemia as part of your algorithm for deciding whether somebody is comfortably tachypneic or like an impending respiratory failure. So in terms of how much I tolerate, ARDS has a predictable trajectory to some degree, okay? Like you can escalate, you plateau for a while, and then you de-escalate. If I capture somebody who is escalating, and I very often feel that unless I get very rapid control of this problem, that is to say, I put them on CPAP or BiPAP, and they immediately, like their respiratory rate goes down, their heart rate normalizes, and their FiO2 is less than 40%, then like I feel like, okay, like maybe I overcalled it. Maybe it wasn't ARDS. Maybe what was happening was it was pneumonia with atelectasis. Now I've reopened their pneumonia with atelectasis. And so like, maybe they're not quite as systemically ill as I had initially thought. Unless that happens, then my mental model is actually more that I'm actually catching ARDS on a trajectory. Some of these patients, you can see their trajectory and their anticipated natural history is going to immediately get worse. And so when you capture them on either high flow or CPAP or BiPAP, you're doing that to set up intubation. You're doing that to like optimize FRC going into intubation, because you can already tell, like if you look like this between 9 a.m. and noon, okay, you're going to be like arresting by 3 p.m. So I'm not going to let you get to 3 p.m. I'm going to like take over now. So if you acknowledge that trajectory, okay, then I think that rate of trajectory is an important part of understanding what you think is going on. So we've talked about natural history. We've talked about trajectory. And finally, FiO2. I think FiO2 is one of the like cheapest PFTs that you have. If you can get a lung to FRC with non-invasive measures, you should not need a lot of FiO2. And if you cannot, okay, then think really hard about your mental model, about like, what are you actually trying to accomplish here? Are you in fact missing somebody on their trajectory and what you are considering like stable because their BiPAP settings or their FiO2 hasn't changed is actually an upward trajectory that you barely stayed ahead of? And that you haven't actually stabilized them, you've just actually missed your one good window to safely intubate. And now the next move is going to be an unsafe intubation. So I think rate of trajectory and FiO2 are probably like what I lean on the most. Okay, this is what I think is going on. And unless I immediately capture it, then I actually feel that, like, you know, you're probably going to get worse before you get better. Yet again, everything is risk-benefit. In certain patients, again, who are not necessarily, frankly, DNR, but like you can see the consequences of intubating would potentially be more dire than not, then like you could have a more nuanced discussion about this. But as a general rule, okay, that's how I would think about it.
That's really helpful to hear your mental framework when you're at the bedside thinking about these patients, thinking about the trajectory, the FiO2 requirement. Practically, for people who aren't as experienced at the bedside, do you think it's helpful to actually have a line in the sand where you say, I won't cross a peak of 12 or I won't cross a peak of 30? You know, if we can't get the FiO2 below 60, do you think that's helpful or is that maybe a little bit too specific?
No, I think that actually is helpful because as long as you stick with it, whatever that number is, I personally like tend not to go above 18 IPAP and EPAPs of 10 and FiO2s of greater than 50%. So if I was able to capture you on 18 over 10, 50%, I may watch you for a bit. And that's like irrespective of age. I do that for like a 1-month-old as I would for an 18-year-old. Because that also comes up sometimes. It's like, does that different meaning number meaning something? But then the other day, I had like a patient with like really bad kyphoscoliosis, okay, in which I say, you know what, like some of that 18 over 10 is just going toward keeping her thorax pressures from becoming negative. And so like I actually tolerated 24 over 12. And we didn't end up intubating her. And so like that ends up being like, okay, like even my own rules are like a little bit soft in that sense. And so I think the important part of this is for a given patient, have a sense of what is failure, recognize it, and then have a plan for if your plan failed, then what? Okay, were you going to go up or were you going to bite the bullet and change the mode to something invasive? Where people get stuck is a more softly defined number in their head of like an approximation of, is this patient better, worse, or same than what they were before? And being a little bit more precise about what you consider better, worse, or same, and being able to act on that, I think is more important. But the nuances, even again, like I told you, like what tendencies I have and what broad number of categories I think of that like I wouldn't exceed. But my actual approach is looking at a given patient at a given time, trying to figure out that whole trajectory, rate of trajectory. And then when I like escalate to a certain point, decide that this is what failure is going to look like. This is either going to work or it isn't. One of two things will happen when I put you at 18 over 10. Your heart rate will either come down by a quarter, your respiratory rate will come down by a quarter, and your FiO2 will go below 50%, or it will not. And if it will not, then I need to trust that what I'm looking at, even if it's a little bit better, even if it's like went from 70 to 60%, you know, if it does not, okay, I need to decide what I'm going to do. And as opposed to dragging that out and being like, oh, let's see what the next hour brings. Let's see what the next hour brings. My own approach to that is that like in critical care, that balance of risk and benefit requires you to not overcall everything, but it requires you to have the courage of your convictions that you have actually seen a failure when you see it. Okay. And so much of pediatrics, I think, ends up working out because kids aren't that sick or they have a level of tolerance for our imperfections that allow us to get by that pediatric critical care isn't quite as tolerant of. And so there, you need to add this additional caveat that like most kids can tolerate some imperfection, but when they start to collapse everything, they're collapsing everything and then they're spiraling. And now you've taken like what could have been a safe intubation to like a peri-arrest intubation. And so that risk-benefit ratio in critical care, particularly for critical care practitioners, I think needs to be like constantly reevaluated. And then when you cross it, buy it, believe yourself, believe that like, I think this is what like improvement looks like and I don't think this can improve. And I think on balance, like it's better for me to intubate safely now than unsafely in 3 hours. Because then you have to have the courage of your own procedural skills and your ability to manage that. And so then it's asking, if I'm wrong and I over-intubated, how long am I wrong for? Am I wrong for a couple days? Do I just pop everything open and then I sign this kid out in the morning and people extubate him within 48 hours or 24 hours? Or like, do I line them? And like, and then if everything's okay, do they pull the lines in a couple hours or like in 6 hours? And if you're comfortable enough with your own judgment on this, then you get to a place where you're like, you know, even if I'm wrong, I'm only wrong for 1 or 2 days. And I think I'd rather be wrong that way than like letting this kid have a cardiac arrest and intubating, right? This judgment, I've been attending since 2011, and I was a PICU fellow starting in 2008. So like, this is not an overnight thing. This is not even a trainee thing. This is a mental model that you have that refines itself over and over. after you get burned and when you've seen things work that you didn't think would work. Okay, so you refine this process over and over, but wanting to get better at this and wanting to think about these things this way as I need to trust my own judgment about this. And like when I escalate, when I don't escalate, like I think that's an important mental model, irrespective of the actual numbers that you personally end up deciding on. Okay, I've had a long time to like kind of come up with my own version of this, right? And so hopefully it'll provide a good starting point for people. Okay, but this really does get refined over your entire life.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's such a beautiful answer to the age-old, not the disease process, but we're talking about here, but the age-old when to intubate a bronchiolytic question, right? Like this is exactly.
I mean, I feel like what makes a pediatric intensivist an intensivist is looking at a really sick patient and knowing how much longer you're going to tolerate these abnormal vital signs before you commit them to a highly morbid procedure, whether it's intubation or ECMO cannulation,
yeah,
or you know, even if it's just lines, whatever it is. And I think that you really displayed that in your answer. And it's definitely something to aspire to as we move on in our training and in our eventual career.
Oh, thanks.
And before we move on, if you've been with me on the unit for like a week and you're a resident, I've said to you what I think is a rumor and not a real rule, but if you have someone in 16 over 8, 50% BiPAP settings, you must write a note in the chart about why you didn't intubate them. And so that changed my mental model as a resident in DC. I think I've said it to many residents emphatically.
Yeah, I could imagine a situation in which I had somebody who had asthma. Okay. And I said that like, yeah, I didn't intubate because I'm confident that if I just pound you with albuterol and give your steroids another 3 hours, the natural history of your process, okay, plus the fact that you're like a strapping 16-year-old with like plenty of muscle who can tolerate additional work of breathing for another like 6 to 8 hours without arresting is why I didn't intubate you. Whereas the same 16 over 8, 50% on a 5-year-old with like pneumonia, you could argue, you know what? This is going to get worse. I should just intubate. And so like, it's not the numbers. It isn't. It's the context of the numbers, the rate of trajectory, your anticipated diagnosis, and your anticipated natural history, and where you think you're falling on that patient's better, worse, or same curve. Yeah.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @critpeds and @pedscrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.